Last time we left David, as he was on his way from the army of Achish, returning back to the city of Ziklag. He had left Achish and the army of the Philistines reluctantly, it would appear. That in itself is a remarkable thing. We would not have expected to find David, the man after God's own heart, so obviously reluctant to leave the company of the wicked. And yet, such is the dullness of the backslider, such is the stupidity of heart and mind of those who lose out with God. And we don't want for a moment when we say that to divorce ourselves from that, because we show the same stupidity and dullness and carelessness of heart and thought and perception when we lose out with God, just like David. But the circumstances here in the mercy of God were above David's control. They were being manipulated by the hand of the Almighty God to David's good and for the advancement of the cause of God in David's life and in the nation of Israel. By virtue of those divinely manipulated circumstances, David is forced to retire. He has no option, but rather at the insistence of the Philistine lords, he must leave the Philistine army and return from Aphek to the city of Ziklag. On the third day after his departure from Aphek, he has come now within sight of the city of Ziklag, coming a path that no doubt he had walked many a time, coming back from the battles that he had foolishly fought during those 16 months, fighting against those enemies listed back in chapter 27, the Gezrites, the Geshurites, and the Amalekites. No doubt there was in his heart the usual human anticipation of being home again. There are few places, or few feelings, perhaps it's better to say, few feelings, like the feeling of coming home. Ziklag had been home for David for 16 months. And perhaps at this point he was eagerly looking forward to home, as were his men, no doubt, being reunited with their families. The faintness of the 200 men immediately following this in the verse 10 might indicate something of the general state of his little band of supporters. They may well have been weary and tired with the march and were looking forward to getting home. But what a sight greeted them as they came to the entrance of the city. Verse 3. So David and his men came to the city, and behold, it was burned with fire. Behold, it was burned with fire. What a sight awaited him as he rounded the corner, perhaps coming round the side of a hill to see the city, or over the brow of a hill to see it below him. And Ziklag had been burned and destroyed. His sin comes back to haunt him. It is very significant to read in the verse 1 that it was the work of the Amalekites. Now the Lord could have used any one of a multitude of different warring tribes and factions from that area who would have only been too happy to have invaded and spoiled and rampaged in Ziklag. But the Lord used the Amalekites. Because there is a link with this, with his former sin. We've already cited the words of chapter 27 in the verse 8, how David had invaded the Geshurites and the Gezrites and the Amalekites. Now David's sin of the past comes back to haunt him. His sin, though he had taken great care to try and cover his steps, ruthlessly slaughtering men, women, and children, lest any would tell on him and would discover his real character and his real plans and ambitions to Achish and the Philistines. He had tried his level best to cover his tracks. But oh, what a knife must have gone into his heart as David realizes, at whatever point he realizes, it's the Amalekites that have done this. And his sin that he thought he had covered has come back to haunt him and to bite him. Despite his best efforts and his best activity, his best action to keep it all quiet, to keep it all secret, it had been uncovered and had come back to roost. The consequences of sin cannot be avoided. We do reap what we sow. We reap exactly what we sow. David reaped the Amalekites. He sowed the Amalekites. He reaped the Amalekites. They came back to destroy all that he had in the city of Ziklag. In Numbers 32:23, there is that familiar statement of Moses, "Be sure your sin will find you out. Be sure it will find you out." Moses did not speak those words to the wicked. He didn't speak them to the heathen or the ungodly. He spoke them to the people of God, in the context speaking to the tribes that wanted to settle on the eastern side of Jordan. "Be sure your sin will find you out. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap." Even the believer. If in backsliding we sow certain seeds of sin, well, you may be sure that the Lord will see to it that we reap the consequences of that sowing. These events in this chapter, however, take a happier turn, because they mark the end of David's backsliding. They mark the period of his restoration to fellowship with God and a renewed pursuit of the will of God and the calling that God had given him that had been absent from his life now for at least these 16 months. He gets back on track, as it were. He is restored to fellowship and communion with God and begins again to take up the calling that the Lord had given. The backslider cannot enjoy communion with God. The backslider cannot enjoy progress in the calling in life that God has given to him. David made no progress as far as the path to the throne was concerned while he was out of touch with God. In fact, if we were to take the time and look at what he did, you will see that there are so many things that were a hindrance to his taking up the throne. What, for instance, would have happened had David persisted in his way with Achish and ended up on the enemy side against Israel? What right-thinking Israelite would ever want to have David on the throne when there would have been a recollection so vividly etched in their minds that when Saul fell and the kingdom was overcome, David was on the other side? Who would have wanted a king like that? And of course, the Lord, in his providence and sovereign mercy and wisdom, overruled David's folly and his backsliding and restored him really at a very crucial time. Because even at this point, the battle with the Philistines is developing. Saul is about to fall in that battle. The throne is going to be wide open. And it really is at a crucial time now that God restores David to fellowship with himself. How merciful the Lord is in that. When even it seems that David, by his folly and his stubbornness and his fleshliness and following the leading of his own heart and getting away from God, seemed he had jeopardized the throne. Now at the most crucial moment, when Saul is about to perish and the way to the throne is to be opened, God in mercy restores David to fellowship with himself, to put him back in the way of pursuing the calling of God for his life. And I want us today just to look at David's restoration from his backslidden ways. It will mean that we will take an overview of the entire chapter. There are some points that we could look at in greater detail, but we will not do that today. We will simply look at the chapter from this perspective and see how God in grace restores the backslider. The first thing you will see is that God melts David's heart. He breaks him, melts him, right down to the point where in verse 4 we are told that David along with his men wept until they had no more power to weep. They cried, their eyes dry, broken hearted, in absolute misery and sorrow of heart and of soul. The Lord breaks David's heart here by bringing home in power to his heart an understanding and a personal experience of the consequences of his sin. The Lord makes real to David in his own experience the consequences of his sin. He comes to recognize, and more than that, to grieve over what he has done as God in chastisement brings home to David's heart the consequences of the sin that he is engaged in. God will not allow the child of God to continue in his sin indefinitely and unchecked. That is a vital lesson that we learn from the restoration of David here. The Lord will not allow any one of his people to go on in sin without checking them in their sin, without chastisement in their sin and for their sin, and ultimately, if there is no turning, and if there is a stubborn persistence in the ways of sin and rebellion, the Lord will deal more or less severely with that child of God. The evidence of true sonship is chastisement over sin. The evidence of belonging to the Lord is that when we wander from the pathway, God does not take that lightly. He does not simply do as so many parents today foolishly do, ignore the sins of their children. He does not, he cannot. It is not in his nature to do it. He, in love and in mercy, but also true to the holiness and the righteousness of his character, will punish his children for sin. He will mete out chastisement. Hebrews chapter 12 makes this abundantly clear. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. Every one whom the Lord loves, he chastens. Every son that belongs to him, he scourgeth. Well, that's not a pleasant term. It envisages corporal punishment of a very severe kind. A painful experience indeed. But it's whom the Lord loves, he chastens. Love chastens sin. Love does not overlook sin. Sadly today, for most people, the term love has been so altered and so redefined as to mean anything and everything but what God actually intends it to mean. This past week I have been exchanging some emails, an exchange that I have terminated with a man in England who signed our guest book on sermon audio, and one of the comments that he made was that he thanked God that he was a homosexual. So I exchanged a few emails with him, and one of the points that he made was this. It's just an illustration of what I'm saying. He referred me to Galatians chapter 5 and the verse 22. The fruit of the Spirit is love. And his logic was very simple. This is a kind of love. This is a fruit of the Spirit. Therefore, this is not sin. Now, that's a redefining of love. But you have churches all over the place redefining love. Here is the love of God. What does it do? It scourgeth every son whom he receives. If God loves you, he will chastise your sin. If he doesn't love you, he will let you get on with your sin. Now that's a very sobering thing. Because there are many who claim to be the Lord's and they live in open disobedience against God. And they are permitted to go on year after year after year after year without any indication that God is intervening to chastise their sin. That's a sobering thing, because that indicates, in the light of this text, they don't belong to the Lord. 16 months is a fairly long period of time. But God intervened. It wasn't going to go on indefinitely. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth. If ye endure chastening, verse 7, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? If ye be without chastisement, again the point is made, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards and not sons. Not the true seed of God at all. An illegitimate seed. Nothing to do with God. Not having his nature. Not his son. Not a child of the Lord. Where there is the absence of chastisement. So the intervention of God in David's life here, and bringing home to him in chastisement the consequences of his sin, is an indication that David was a child of God. That the Lord had loved him. The Lord had an interest in his case. This is not to be seen, you know, as an evidence of divine harshness, cruelty, or a lack of love. It is rather to be seen as the very opposite, because it was the evidence. Perhaps I may be so bold as to say, because David was living in a backslidden state, this was one of the very few evidences at this time that David actually was a child of God. One of the few evidences was the chastisement that the Lord visited upon him because of his sin. He suffered great personal loss in this chastisement. It was loss that broke his heart. We have already read the verse 4. And verse 5 indicates that David's two wives were taken captives, and every man there was grieved for his sons and for his daughters. And as the Lord lays upon David the rod of chastisement, he comes to learn something very important, that his backsliding has an effect upon his family. His backsliding has an effect upon those who are nearest and dearest to him. This principle is seen to be worked out as well in the lives of his men who had followed David into the ways of backsliding and departure from God. Now, no doubt David had the greater culpability since he was the leader. He had led them in that way. And yet each man is accountable for his own sin and for his own departure from the Lord. And that backsliding, that departure from God, what did it do? What did it result in? It resulted in the captivity of wives, sons, and daughters. That's what backsliding does. We lose out with God. It has an impact in our homes. It has an impact in our families. On sons and daughters. Sons and daughters in captivity to the enemy, because David and his men, the fathers in the household especially, had lost out with God. Now there is a very real lesson to be learned here, and it's a painful lesson, I'm sure, but nonetheless it has to be learned. Here is David, picture him weeping until his eyes are dry. He cannot weep anymore. His heart is broken. As he realizes, because I lost out with God, my children are in captivity. In David's case, there's no record that there were children at this point, but his two wives are especially referred to. But many a father in his little band had to bow his head and in sorrow of heart recognize, because of my sin, my son's in captivity. My daughter's in captivity. I lost out with God along the way. That's what backsliding does. Many a child of God has to testify that that is indeed the reality. That's the truth.
lose out with God and lose the family. Here is an awful lesson to have to learn. It's a lesson we do well to learn from David's experience rather than live it out ourselves in our own experience. But here's what backsliding does. Here's what losing out with God does. There's a price attached with it. David has to recognize it brokenheartedly. I lost out, Lord. And I've lost my family. Lost them. They're in the hand of the enemy. It is certainly possible, most likely, that David knew or at least had a fond hope in his heart that they were still alive at this point. We know, as we read verse 2, that they had not slain any of their captives. David and his men would have had some suggestion of that, although not absolutely sure of it, but no doubt as they surveyed the wreckage of Ziklag, they didn't discover any corpses or bodies there, and so they would have thought, well, they've taken them captive. At least they're still alive. There's still hope here. As we shall see, it was a hope that was realized as David got right again with God. The family that he had lost, the families that his men had lost, were recovered. As David was recovered from his backsliding. But let us at least learn now this aspect of the price of backsliding. Backsliding will cost us our family. It cost David his, at least temporarily. It cost him more than that, because Ziklag, as a city, represented all that David had lived for the past 16 months. That was his base. It was from there he had gone out to fight his battles. It was to there that he had carried back whatever spoil he had taken from the Gezrites, the Geshurites and the Amorites, or the Amalekites. Ziklag represented all that he had lived for in those 16 months of backsliding. And it's all gone. It is all reduced to ashes. 16 months of his life up in smoke because he lost out with God. 16 months in which all that he had labored for was reduced to nothing. All the work that he engaged in was completely gone, burned to the ground. That's the cost of losing out with God. I'm not saying that that will be the cost in a natural sense, as it was with David here, but it certainly will be the cost in a spiritual sense. We have looked recently at that passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Let me just remind you of it in the verse 13, where Paul speaks of those who build wood, hay and stubble. And what happens in the day of the Lord? It's all reduced to ashes. And there are those there. Oh, they're God's people, as surely as David was a child of God here. But they stand before the Lord in the midst of ashes. All they've labored for, and all they've worked for, was an absolute waste of time. Because they weren't living for God. They were, even as David was, in his backsliding. The prospect of such a loss as this, the loss of the family, the loss of all that we labor for, to stand before God in that day with nothing but ashes, the prospect of that should check our tendency to stray from the Lord into the paths of backsliding. This should stand and serve as a warning to everyone who reads it, not to go back, not to let slip the things that we have learned, not to let slip the things and the progress that we have made, but rather to press on with God in the paths of holiness and of righteousness. God melts David's heart by bringing home to him the price of his sin and the ruin that it brings even into the life of a child of God.
Further distress is caused here by the threatened mutiny of his men in verse 6. David was greatly distressed, for the people spake of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man, or bitter, every man for his sons and for his daughters. These men represented those who in Israel had rallied to the cause of God as that cause had been embodied in David. These were men who recognized he is God's man, he is God's king. And although Saul sits on the throne for a while, this is God's choice for the kingdom. And we're going to stand with that man. We're going to rally around him. And together they had stood under God against Saul's campaigns of harassment. Together they had proved God's mighty deliverances as time after time the Lord stepped in, not only to deliver David, but to deliver all his band of faithful supporters. But now something very tragic happened. And it teaches us a very solemn lesson. To live as David had lived, and of course his men had followed with him in that course of backsliding as well, but to live in that way, to lose out with God, whether we're thinking of an individual or a band of people. It started out rallying around God's man. He had, under God's call and under the anointing of God, had stood for the Lord and obeyed God for a time, but he'd lost out. These men lost out with God as well. The path of backsliding will ultimately bring dissension and disruption and bitterness and upheaval and strife into the cause of God. This little band that had been welded together in harmony for a time, and they had moved as one man through the land of Israel, moving from place to place as Saul had assaulted and harassed them. This little band that had come through thick and thin with David, who had jeopardized their lives for David, now are ready to stone him. What an awful change. The harmony is replaced by trouble, disquiet, squabbling. The little band that was as one is fractured and broken up in schism. The personal popularity that David had enjoyed evaporates. The loyalty that he had known from his men is gone, at least temporarily. And all that is displaced with distrust and even with murderous thought. How dramatic is the change here. But that's the price of backsliding. Whether we're thinking of a congregation or an individual, we lose out with God. Harmony goes. Peace goes. Where there may well have been unity in a congregation, where there is a losing out with God, there is trouble. Every backslider in the ranks of the people of God becomes a source of trouble. That's the reality of what happens here. David is facing the prospect of being stoned by his men. And in these ways, God melts David's heart. He removes from him every temporal support. His city is gone. His men, their support is gone. His wives are gone. And David is reduced to nothing, and to see what his sin has robbed him of. And God melts his heart by the chastisement that he meets out on this occasion. The second thing we want to observe here is that David is driven by that chastisement to seek the Lord. He is driven by the chastisement to seek God. in his distress, he turns to the Lord, verse 6. But there's a turning point. But David encouraged himself in the Lord his God. David did not try to reason with his men, to try to rally them once more and so to derive encouragement from them. But David here turns to the Lord his God. He has no family to turn to. His city is gone. The support and friendship of his men is gone. But he turns to the Lord. Divine chastisement is, as we have seen, an evidence of love. It is a means of grace. It is a means of God communicating grace to his children in love. If we were to go back to Hebrews chapter 12 and the verse 10, you would discover there that the reason for chastisement is this: that we might be partakers of his holiness. That's why God chastises. It is a means of grace. We get down to the level of church government, a different area of the direct chastising touch of the Lord. But on occasion, in the church, discipline is necessary. There must be disciplinary measures taken against members for this sin or that. It's not something that occurs in harshness and cruelty. It is rather simply a reflection of God's principle in chastisement. It is a means of grace. It is something that is inflicted, designed to produce the recovery of the offender. That's why the Lord chastises David here. It is to recover him, to get him back to the ways of holiness, to get him back to the ways of godliness and righteousness. You'll see that David turns to the Lord for strength here in the verse 6. He encouraged or strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Now, what effect has divine chastisement produced on David? It has produced a sense of his weakness. He needs strength. He recognizes then, you see, that in these circumstances, Lord, such is my need right now. I need the power of God to deal with these circumstances. Now, this contrasts very sharply with the bravado and self-reliance and self-confidence that comes through between the lines of the historical record of his activities in that 16 months. He was so sure of himself when he was trading sort of double-meaning statements with Achish. He was being very clever. He was so sure of himself there that he could handle himself just fine. Thank you very much. I don't need to leave. I can go with you, and I can so engage in fancy footwork and fancy tongue work that I'll keep myself right. But God breaks his heart, and what's the first thing he realizes? I need the power of God. I can do nothing. David encouraged or strengthened himself, literally as the word is, he strengthened himself in the Lord his God. And all that self-confidence of the past is gone. And the sense of powerlessness that was conspicuously absent previously is now present. As before God, he confesses his weakness, and he needs and requires and prays for the strength of God. No doubt he seeks strength here to bear up under the distress that his sin has caused. Lord, I brought this on myself. But Lord, will you not give me the strength to bear with it? Will you not give me the strength to bear with the consequences of my sin? Lord, lift me up. Strengthen me to stand again. Most likely he seeks the power of God that he might be able to put things right, that he might be able to undo as far as is humanly possible, to undo what he had done and to turn things around and to get back on the right path again. Can you imagine the thoughts that would have crossed his mind? He's sitting in Ziklag.
Maybe now beginning to realize what's going to happen with Saul, wondering, is this the time? Because he had earlier said, just a short time before, he shall descend into battle and shall perish. And he's maybe wondering, how do I ever get back? How do I ever get back to where I was? Only the Lord can take the backslider back and get him back and get him restored. Because humanly speaking, there is no way back. The mess that the backslider gets himself or herself into, it can't be sorted out by human ingenuity. It requires the power of God. And I can hear David pray, Lord, here's where I have got myself in my backsliding and sin. Lord, if I'm ever to get back, if I'm ever to be what I once was, indeed, if I'm ever to be what the Lord has called me to be again, I must have the power of God. And this is what he prays for. He is obviously then back in the place of prayer. Verse 7 and 8, he calls for Abiathar and to bring the ephod. And in verse 8, David inquired at the Lord, saying, shall I pursue after this troop? Shall I overcome them? He's back seeking with the Lord. And he seeks the mind of God. You see how prayer becomes instantly a priority. Now think about what's happening here. Think about what he prays for. Put yourself in that situation and you will see just how much of a priority David made prayer now. Shall I pursue? Don't you think? I know if I was there, every fiber of my soul and being would have been itching to go after them. They've got my family. Don't you think that's how you would have reacted? Don't you think that that would have been the all-consuming desire of your heart and mind? What did David do? He stopped to pray and say, Lord, shall I pursue? Now, I think if you put yourself into that situation and imagine what it would be like for you to get before God and say, Lord, do I pursue or do I stay home? And with every natural feeling in your heart wanting to go, yet putting that in subjection to the will of God and getting before God and praying and saying, Lord, will I go or will I stay? Doesn't matter what I feel. Doesn't matter how my heart throbs with desire wanting to go. I'm going to make this a matter for prayer. That, I think, helps us to understand the priority that David gave now to prayer. It's a priority that wasn't there before, but it's back now. Because God, in his chastising love and mercy, has broken David's heart with the desire, with the purpose, to bring him back to himself. He has realized his weakness. He gets to the place of prayer for guidance and for direction. It's interesting, too, just to observe that David makes use of the proper God-ordained means for prayer. He calls for Abiathar, who was the priest, indeed an acting high priest, really. He has the ephod, part of which was the breastplate. The ephod was the prayer garment of the priest as he went in to represent the people of God before God on the basis of the sacrifice. David says, Abiathar, you bring me the ephod. He doesn't say, we don't have time for that. I don't have time for Abiathar. I'm just going to say a quick prayer now and then I'll be on my way. No. He sent for Abiathar. Abiathar, bring the ephod. We're going to do this the right way. We're going to seek the Lord the right way. We're going to get before God the way he has appointed. We're going to take and humble ourselves to go the path that he has set out before us in his word, and that's how we're going to do it. That's the Lord at work here. He's driven by
divine chastisement to seek God in the place of prayer by the divinely appointed means. Here's the wonderful thing. To seek God under chastisement is to seek Him with confidence. It's a marvelous thing. Perhaps it seems at first a strange contradiction. But for the backslider under chastisement to seek God and to get before God in prayer in that state, he can pray with absolute confidence. Why? God loves me. He's dealing with my sin. God is dealing with my sin to bring me back to Himself. Therefore, I can pray in full assurance, knowing that He who chastises me will hear me as I pray for restoration, for forgiveness, and for recovery. Don't you see how the Lord shows a wonderful readiness to respond here? Verse 8, David inquired at the Lord, saying, "Shall I pursue? Shall I overtake?" And He answered him. Right there, right then, He answered him. Pursue. For thou shalt surely overtake them, and without fail recover all. Now, it's only at this point that David is actually restored to communion with God. You think about it. He's a backslider. God chastises him for his sin. He begins to pray. But it is only as God answers his prayer that communion with God is restored. Communion with God is a two-way thing. Communion with God is not one-sided. Communion with God is not me praying. Communion with God is me praying, God answering. A two-way fellowship with God. And it is only now then that that communion with God is restored. And the end of chastisement has been realized. David has been brought to pray, to see his weakness, to cry out to the Lord for strength. He begins to seek the Lord for guidance, and God answers him. And I say that when we find ourselves under the chastising stroke of the Lord, our Heavenly Father, we can seek God with confidence. We know He has an interest in us. We know that it is in love, and the Lord will hear our cry. There's an interesting little footnote of application in Hebrews chapter 12, where we have been reading about chastisement. No chastening for the present, verse 11, seemeth to be joyous but grievous. It's a heavy thing. Nevertheless, afterward it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. Wherefore, now listen to this. Wherefore, lift up the hands which hang down, and confirm the feeble knees. Now, I have no doubt that the primary meaning of those words is be strong. You've let your hands hang down. Get back in the work. But you will know that it is a common enough idea in the Word of God that when the Christian lifts his hands, he's engaging in prayer. He's engaging in prayer. God chastens. Wherefore, lift up the hands that hang down. You've forgotten to pray. You've let those praying hands fall, but lift them up. Why? Because God is chastening you. And because of that, pray. Pray, because it's only in prayer that communion with God is restored. And there's restoration from backsliding. What does the Lord do here? He gives strength. Verse 6, David encouraged himself. He strengthened himself in the Lord. God responds by giving him strength. The Lord responds by giving him a clear word of guidance. Shall I pursue? Pursue. Nothing could be clearer than that. The Lord gives him a clear promise, which he fully fulfills. Pursue, for thou shalt surely overtake them, and without fail recover all. And David recovered all, verse 18. There was nothing lacking to them, verse 19. And again, David recovered all. That's what the Lord gave David. Strength, guidance, a fulfilled promise,
of recovery. Wonderful tokens of divine goodwill toward him. Turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 12. There's a wonderful little detail recorded over there, 1 Chronicles 12 and the verse 19. Speaking of the enlarging of David's cause that was happening even at this time as he is getting close to the throne. Verse 19, 1 Chronicles 12. And there fell some of Manasseh to David when he came with the Philistines against Saul to battle. But they helped them not. For the lords of the Philistines, upon advisement, sent him away, saying, he will fall to his master Saul to the jeopardy of our heads. As he went to Ziklag, there fell to him of Manasseh, Adnah, and Jozabad, and Jediel, and Michael, and Jozabad, and Elihu, and Zophai, captains of the thousands that were of Manasseh, and they helped David against the band of the rovers, for they were all mighty men of valor, and were captains in the host. For at that time, day by day, there came to David to help him, until it was a great host, like the host of God. Isn't that a marvelous thing? Even when he was going to Ziklag, even as the Lord was dealing with him to restore him, day by day, representatives of the thousands of Manasseh, mighty men of valor who helped him against the band of the rovers. Is that a reference to the Amalekites? I take it to be so. They helped him in the recovery of his family and of his possessions. The Lord said, I'll give you a promise. I'll give you more men. I'll build your cause. All these wonderful things, tokens of divine goodwill. And what does that suggest to us? It simply suggests the thought that we're emphasizing, that for the backslider under chastisement, you can seek God with confidence. Confidence that he'll restore, confidence that he'll hear, that he'll bless, that he'll guide, that he'll add, that he'll develop, that there will be recovery. Finally and very quickly, let me point out the evidences of spiritual restoration. And I'm just going to pick out the highlights of the rest of the chapter that follow on from David's restoration to fellowship with God. A number of features about his behavior in the rest of the chapter that are very instructive, that follow on from his restored communion with the Lord. First of all, in verse 9, there is a renewed obedience to God's command. The Lord said, pursue. So David went. There you have simple obedience. He did what he was told. Not merely the action of the natural heart, because as I've said already, he suppressed that in order to pray and to seek the mind of God. This was not just natural inclination. He put that down. He said, I'm going to pray. I'm going to seek the will of God. And the Lord said, go, and he went. Why did he go? I believe that we have to see not the natural inclination at work, but rather simple obedience to the command of God. That's why he went. That's the only reason why he went. He went to obey God's command. This is the duty of the restored backslider. Get back to the place of obedience. In a general sense, that's true. Let's think of a specific application here. What did the Lord say? Pursue, for thou shalt surely overtake them, and without fail recover all. Here's the command of God to the restored backslider. You work to recover what has been lost. So David went. Might be your family. Work to recover them. Oh, you can go to that work with a promise. God has said to David here, and I believe that anyone who finds themselves in this situation can take comfort from these words, pursue and thou shalt overtake them and without fail recover all. Maybe we have members of our families that it seems are getting farther from God. They're in the grip of the enemy. The enemy's taking them captive. They're going away every minute that passes. They're getting further and further and further away from us.
And it seems that the task of pursuit is getting harder and harder and harder.
Encourage yourself in the Lord. Take the strength of God gained in the place of prayer. Go after them. Go after them. That's what David did.
He recognized they had been lost because of his backsliding. But in his prayer and his contrition, he obtained the strength of God and the clear command of God.
Go after them, David, and go with a confidence that the Lord has said, you'll recover them. You'll recover them.
What would we think of David had he sat down here in unbelief and said, Lord, they're too far away. They've got too big a head start. I'll never catch up with them now. I don't have the legs for this fight anymore. I've cried myself senseless. And I think anybody that has ever had that experience knows how draining it is, even physically, never mind emotionally. How am I to go after them now, Lord? I'm done. I don't have the legs for it.
God said, go. I'll give you the strength. You go get them. And you'll surely overtake them. And without fail, recover them all.
What a promise that must have been. How sweet that would have been for David. Because you see, for David, he could put names in the promise here. He could put the names of his wife in. There were many among his own men who no doubt now were restored with him to follow him in this recovery plan.
They could put names in. Every one of them that was married had a name of a wife. I'm going to go after her. I'm going to see that the command of God is obeyed, and I'm going to do what it takes to get her back. I'll be children, sons or daughters. And I'm going to go, and even though I don't have the legs for it, I'm going to go in the strength of the Lord, leaning on his promise. Oh God, you've said, if I pursue, I'll overtake and I'll recover.
We need to do that. Here's a promise from the Lord. It's renewed obedience to God's command. That's a mark of restoration. A desire to recover what has been lost. Then there's tenderness of heart. Tenderness toward his own men. There were 200 that were so faint that they could not go over the brook Besor. He lets them stay there. Then later on, when the 400 recover, he shoots down the wicked suggestion of the men of Belial. It was a devilish thing for them to suggest that these men should be cut out of the reward. David recognizes this. It's just a suggestion of Satan. Not going to have anything to do with that. No. And in tenderness of heart, he says to these men, no, as his part is that goes to the battle, so his part shall be that tarries by the stuff. There's going to be an even division here. That's tenderness of heart. Tenderly acting now toward his own men, even when they speak sinfully, some of them, and speak with the voice and the words of the devil. Tenderly he deals with them, rebuking their words and insisting on that which is right. Tenderness toward the dying stranger, verse 11 to 15, the Egyptian servant of the Amalekite. Remember how ruthless David had been just in the previous chapter, slaughtering, butchering men, women and children in order to cover his ways. See what he does here now. Here's a poor soul on the very edge of hell. What does he do? He does what he can to recover him. He gives him water. He gives him bread. He gives him a cake of raisins. He pledges to him, I'll not betray you to your master who abandoned you. No, I'll take you into my ranks. You can be my servant. He spares his life. If we had the time, you could see there a wonderful illustration of the gospel, the saving work of Christ, recovering sinners who have been abandoned to death by the abusive master, even the devil that they serve. But David shows tenderness of heart. Then he's back in the battle, a divinely appointed war, waging battle, a battle not of his own devising, but of a battle that has been commanded him of the Lord. And it's now, and only now, that he discovers victory in the place of former defeat. I've said already that he was fighting against the Amalekites previously. He knew some limited success for a little while in his own strength and his own strategies and devising. But the Amalekites came back and wiped out Ziklag. Utter devastation and defeat. You see, you can't fight the Lord's battles in your own strength. Whatever little progress may be made, it's only temporary. It'll come to nothing and it'll lead to utter ruin. But he's back in the battle at God's command, and he gets the victory now. It's the place of former defeat, enemies that had overcome him and had robbed him of his family and of everything that he had. But he gets the victory. He recognizes this victory to be of the Lord. In verse 23, the Lord hath given us the victory. It's the Lord who hath preserved us and delivered the company that came against us into our hand. Then the final thing in the chapter that is an illustration and an evidence of his restoration to fellowship with God is that he acts to restore good relations and fellowship with those who had been his friends in former times. Verse 26 and following, he comes to Ziklag, and he sent of the spoil unto the elders of Judah, even to his friends, saying, behold, a present for you of the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. And there are a number of little towns mentioned there. And verse 31, a summary statement to all the places where David and himself and his men were wont to haunt, or literally where they used to walk. Now that's a suggestive thought right there. There were places David used to walk, places he used to frequent, where he had friends, supporters, allies, those who loved him, those who stood with him. But those friendships had been broken when David backslid and lost out with God. For 16 months, he was out of touch with these dear souls that has helped him. And what does he do as soon as he's restored to fellowship with God? He begins to rebuild the friendships of the past. Think of it on a very practical level. When someone backslides, inevitably one of the first signs of that is they don't walk where they used to walk. Their footstep used to be heard in the house of God, among the saints of the Lord, in the prayer meeting, in the services. But they've got away from the Lord and the friendships are broken. One of the very first evidences of restoration will be a desire to rebuild those friendships. A desire to get back and walk in the same old places among the people of God where they used to walk. That's what David did. God restored him. Under chastisement, he is restored to communion and fellowship with God. The evidence of it is to be seen here in the chapter, in his desire to recover what had been lost, in the tenderness of heart to those who were his own and those who were strangers, in his victory in the battle where once he had been defeated, in his desire to restore fellowship and friendship with the people of God. That's what restoration is. That's what every backslider needs. May God in mercy be pleased to teach us and to apply these words to our hearts for the Savior's sake. Let's bow in prayer.